Thank you for downloading Business Matters from the BBC World Service. 50 minutes of interviews and discussion on the day's big news stories and themes from Asia, America, and across the globe.
It's midnight GMT. Hello, I'm Rob Young and this is Business Matters on the BBC World Service. Today we're live from London, Bangkok and Philadelphia in the US. Our top story. The United States has just declared a telecommunications national emergency, paving the way for a ban on equipment made by the controversial Chinese firm Huawei. We'll get the latest. Also this hour, internet companies and governments promise to do more to combat extremism online in the wake of the Christchurch mosque attacks. And we explore the economic consequences of a falling birth rate. That's all in Business Matters after the latest BBC News.
Hello, I'm Chris Berrow with the BBC News. President Trump has declared a national emergency to protect US communications networks against what he calls foreign adversaries. He signed an executive order, in effect, barring American companies from using overseas telecoms firms believed to pose a security risk to the US. This report from Peter Bowes.
According to a statement from the White House, the president's order aims to protect America from foreign adversaries who are actively and increasingly creating and exploiting vulnerabilities in information and communications technology infrastructure and services. No company is named in the order, although it's likely that it's directed at the Chinese telecommunications giant Huawei. The company, which is the world's largest maker of telecoms equipment, has denied that its work poses any risks of espionage or sabotage, but a number of countries have raised concerns that its products could be used by China for surveillance.
The head of the ruling military council in Sudan has said that talks with pro-democracy leaders have been suspended for 72 hours. Roger Walker reports.
Speaking on television, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan said roadblocks put up by protesters in recent days in the capital Khartoum would be cleared. Earlier, protest leaders had said the military had made dismantling the barricades a condition of resuming negotiations. They'd been due to restart on Wednesday to discuss the composition of a supreme authority to govern Sudan during a 3-year transition period agreed the day before. There was more violence in Khartoum on Wednesday. At least 9 people were wounded when soldiers opened fire on protesters outside army headquarters.
One of the leaders of the Houthi rebels in Yemen has told the BBC that the group's attack on an oil pipeline in Saudi Arabia on Tuesday had nothing to do with the rising tensions between Iran and the US. Mohammed Ali al-Houthi denied that Iran had a say. Sebastian Usher reports.
The attack on a major pipeline in Saudi Arabia raised the stakes even higher in the region as the US squares off against Iran. For the US, the Houthis are simply a proxy force for Tehran, but the full extent of Iran's support remains shadowy. Mohammed Ali al-Houthi said the Houthis were defending themselves against the Saudi-led coalition it's been fighting for 4 years and not acting on Iran's behalf. He said the drones used in the pipeline attack were made locally. He scoffed at the idea that Iran could smuggle in missiles when even a loaf of bread couldn't get through the coalition blockade. His denials won't sway Washington, which has ordered non-essential government staff in Iraq to leave over fear of attack by Iranian-backed militias.
The United States government has ordered the suspension of all commercial passenger and cargo flights between the US and Venezuela. The Department of Transportation cited reports of violence around airports, which they said threatened the safety of passengers and crew. World news from the BBC.
Hello and welcome to Business Matters. I'm Rob Young. On the programme today, we'll try to work out what this new US national emergency when it comes to telecommunications means for companies. We'll go live to one of our correspondents in the US in just a moment. We'll hear from the head of the American Aviation Regulator about the grounded fleet of Boeing 737 MAX aircraft. And later on, man versus machine in the ancient Chinese game of Go. As always, I'll be joined throughout the programme by two guests on opposite sides of the world. With us today, we have Nisid Hajjari, the Asia editor for Bloomberg Opinion. He joins us from Bangkok. Hi, Nisid.
Good morning, Rob.
And we also have Maya Van Rossum, director of the Delaware Riverkeeper Network. She's an environmentalist, lawyer and author, and she's in Philadelphia in the US. Now, the Chinese tech giant Huawei is engaged in activities that are contrary to US national security or foreign policy interest, according to the Trump administration. The US president has just declared a national emergency, barring American companies from using foreign telecoms equipment deemed a security risk. US officials have also been trying to persuade allies not to allow China to have a role in building the next generation 5G superfast mobile networks. Huawei is the world's biggest provider of telecoms equipment. Well, the two biggest economies have a tense trading relationship as that escalating trade war rages. The BBC's Peter Bowes joins us now from the US. He's in Los Angeles. Hi, Peter.
Hi there.
What is the justification then for this national emergency when it comes to telecoms?
Well, to use the language of Donald Trump, his administration is doing what it takes to keep America safe and prosperous. Now, more specifically, according to the White House statement, the president's order aims to protect America from foreign adversaries, although it's not entirely clear what and to whom that refers. Foreign adversaries who, the statement says, who are actively and increasingly creating and exploiting vulnerabilities in information and communications technology infrastructure and services. Now, the White House statement adds that the executive order gives the Secretary of Commerce here the power to prohibit transactions posing an unacceptable risk to national security. The White House also points out that this is an agnostic executive order. No company, no country is named specifically, although it is likely that the order is directed, as you have implied, towards the Chinese telecommunications giant Huawei. This is the world's largest maker of telecoms equipment. Of course, the US has long been known to be nervous about what they are doing, and it seems that they have this company in its sights.
How will this work then? What will be the process for American companies if they want to say, when they're setting up the 5G network, use something by Huawei of China or a European company like Siemens? Is there now going to be some kind of process that they will have to go through?
Yes, although the framework isn't entirely clear yet. I understand that over the next 150 days, the Commerce Department will define what the order means, essentially write a new rulebook for reviewing transactions that fall under the ban. And it does only apply to future transactions. And they will come up with a framework criteria to ban companies from selling equipment to the United States that clearly come within this particular framework. I think, again, a lot will hinge on this key question of how foreign adversaries are defined.
Yes, there was a separate document from the Department of Commerce which has mentioned Huawei, and they put it on something called the entity list, which means that there are some period of time now where the Department of Commerce will consult on what should happen when it comes to transactions with Huawei. But Huawei has said for a very long time, when there have been suspicions about it, that it is not, has never been engaged in any kind of spying or cyber espionage. The founder of the company has said they would rather shut the whole thing down than obey any order from Beijing to spy in a country where Huawei kit is being used. But is that what this is all about? Is this really about the United States trying to bar Huawei from the US, whatever the real reasons may well be?
It does seem to be a stage in that process. And you're right, Huawei have come out very strongly to deny that their equipment could be used in surveillance operations. But this US action does seem to be, if not the first shot, one of many towards perhaps an eventual ban. And as you say, the Department of Commerce has today said that there is a reasonable basis to conclude that Huawei is engaged in activities that are contrary to the US national security or foreign policy interest. And you mentioned this entity list. It's really an extra layer of scrutiny when American technology is sold to a company that's on the list. So I think it is fair to say that the US very much has Huawei in its sights.
Thank you, Peter. That's the BBC's Peter Bowes there, joining us from Los Angeles. Nisid from Bloomberg Opinion in Bangkok. Do you think the US is right to take a tough line on Huawei? Does it have legitimate reasons for questioning the role that Huawei may well play when it comes to US national security?
Yes, I definitely think it does. It's important to be clear. Critics have said, well, look, the U.S. has never shown any evidence that Huawei has built backdoors into its technology or that it's engaged in espionage. And you've heard those denials from them. But, you know, the fact is that no denials from any Chinese company on this matter are really credible. Any Chinese company, private or state-owned, will have to obey whatever the Chinese government wants when it wants it. So it may not need anything right now. But with this technology, it's not like you build it and you send it over to the U.S. and then that's it. It's constantly patched. It's constantly updated. You can insert, eavesdropping and things like that at any point along the process. And the fact is, for the U.S. in particular, if you have a system where the company involved can build in sort of a kill switch, can shut it off in the case of an outright conflict, that's an unacceptable risk. I mean, it may be a very, very small risk. It may involve, only come into play if the U.S. and China are actively at war, but it's still a risk.
Mm. So we've had allies of the U.S. like Australia, which seems to agree with the White House view, and it has barred Huawei from its future telecoms network. But the U.K. has not taken as hard a line. We believe it will not be allowed in the core of the brains, if you like, of Britain's 5G network, but may well be allowed in other parts of it. And so there is this disagreement among allies, who say Huawei should perhaps be allowed in, say, well, if you look at the evidence, the fact you can't find these backdoors means there perhaps isn't a problem. So is there an argument to say that this NISID is perhaps more about American protectionism?
I don't think so, because it's not like there are American companies that can replace Huawei. There are no American companies that produce this particular equipment. So, this isn't an attempt to hand business over to some U.S. national champions and so on. I think it is a legitimate security concern. There is a debate about which parts of the system are safe, if any of them are safe, and so on, and different countries can make different judgments on that. And also it depends on the country, right? If you're a country in Africa with limited resources, you're going to assume that everyone's spying on you, whether you're using Western equipment or Chinese equipment. And so most people just decide, well, we'll go with the cheaper equipment. If you're the UK, if you're a NATO ally, if you're the US, I think your calculations have to be different.
All right. Thanks for now, Nisid. You're with Business Matters on the BBC World Service. Now, after the fatal crashes of two aircraft, Boeing has been under pressure to fix its fleet of 737 MAX jets and explain what went wrong. The focus has been on an automated system that malfunctioned called MCAS. The Federal Aviation Administration says it expects Boeing to submit a software fix for approval soon. But the FAA has also been under pressure as it initially approved the new type of aircraft. The agency's acting head, Dan Elwell, told Congress the fleet wouldn't be allowed back in the air unless it's safe to fly.
We will do a thorough and robust safety analysis. We will determine, based on the software fix they give us, we'll determine what level of training will be required of 737 MAX pilots. And then once we have established all of that, and internally the FAA review says that the 737 MAX is safe to fly, then the prohibition order will be lifted.
Well, Dan Elwell also said he was concerned by Boeing's lengthy delay in disclosing the anomaly on 737 MAX planes. It's also emerged the aircraft maker resisted calls for safety improvements to the 737 MAX when it met pilots from American Airlines after a crash in Indonesia in October. The talks were held nearly 4 months before a second 737 MAX crashed in Ethiopia. Well, I ask the aviation analyst Sally Gethin what we've learned from these congressional hearings about events that led up to those two fatal crashes.
The FAA knew a lot of problems were going on, and they don't seem to have stepped up and accepted responsibility for their own role in all of this. So today, at the hearing, the FAA acting administrator, Daniel Elwell, said he knew after the Lion Air crash that there was a problem with this MCAS system. He apparently said that as a former pilot, it got all his pilot juices flowing. That was before the Ethiopian Airlines crash, and yet he hasn't really explained that, why at that point he didn't intervene or the FAA did not intervene, especially given the fact that there's this new software fix due to be rushed out, the software fix to the MCAS system, and the MCAS system is the reason that the aircraft came down, as far as we can tell at this stage.
So do you think there needs to be changes then to the way aircraft are approved in the United States?
Absolutely. There absolutely needs to be changes. And because Boeing is the primary aircraft manufacturer globally as well, and it's the primary one in the United States, then they are supposed to set an example to the rest of the world. And it's also very troubling now that the FAA is trying to get foreign regulators on its side. It's going to have a meeting at the end of the month with a number of overseas aviation safety regulators. And so if it convinces them that it's never going to happen again, then those regulators might be convinced. So that is of concern as well, because really, we haven't yet heard the full story of the FAA's relationship with Boeing. What we do know is that the FAA delegated to Boeing employees its own job. It left the work that it was supposed to do to Boeing employees, and there are issues there. So basically, Boeing is in charge of everything. Where does this leave the FAA? I would say with a red, embarrassed face.
There is this software fix being developed by Boeing. How long do you think it could take for it to be approved and for the global fleet of 737 MAX to be back in the air?
The emphasis seemed to be on getting the MAX back up in the air. And of course, that is also due to cost, because airlines are hemorrhaging money right now. They had to ground their MAXes, and they had to reschedule their other aircraft, their fleets, and that cost them a lot of time and money. So there's a lot of money being lost, and also Boeing faces potentially a lot of lawsuits. Boeing needs, as a company, to get the MAX operational to be able to restore its financial fortunes as well. We still haven't yet had the full report from the Ethiopian Airlines crash. So it seems to me a bit preemptive to get that plane flying up in the air, get the new fix certified, and business as usual. There's another aspect to this. Will the travelling public actually fly on the new MAX? Because go onto any social media platforms or anything where the public are listened to, and they don't. Many of them do not want to get on board a MAX again. So the brand of the MAX has been tarnished as well. So we have to wait and see whether, even if they get the aircraft back up in the air, whether airlines will be able to convince their customers to get back on board, literally in this case.
That was the aviation analyst Sally Gethin there. Well, let's have a word with Nissat Hajjari in Bangkok and Maya Van Rossum, who joins us from Philadelphia, despite the gremlins who are trying to keep you off the air, Maya. Maya, you're frightened of flying.
Yes, I'm very frightened of flying. I actually do it quite a bit, and every time I have to get on that plane, I'm very, very nervous.
Right. So what does news about people questioning the regime that approves the safety of aircraft due to your desire to fly, yet the next time you perhaps have to try to get on a plane?
Yeah, I think that I have lost a tremendous amount of confidence in the U.S. government when it comes to their oversight of the safety of planes, because they were so slow to react to the Boeing situation when the rest of the world was acting quickly. And I have to say that I really have no confidence in Boeing at this point, period, not only because of how they handled the MAX 737 situation, but we've been hearing about a lot of whistleblowers that have been coming forward exposing all kinds of problems at Boeing and how they're constructing their planes. And neither Boeing nor the FAA, right, the federal government, has been giving due regard to these whistleblowers and addressing the very serious concerns. So I don't want to get on any Boeing plane, to be honest.
Nissa, do you think there needs to be a change to the way that aircraft are certified as safe, perhaps not just in the United States, but elsewhere?
Well, I think part of the problem in the U.S. Is, and this has been a problem for a long time, is that as the FAA has been starved of resources, it's had to farm out a lot of its work to the companies themselves, which, you know, isn't entirely as crazy as it sounds, because obviously Boeing has an interest in making sure something like this doesn't happen. But still, it's something that needs to be looked at. We can't just rely on the regulators that we have the way we used to before. As Maya said, regulators around the world are not just going to take the word of the FAA anymore. China is a massive market for Boeing. Chinese airline regulators are much better than they used to be. They were the first to ground the plane. And that's something that Boeing and Airbus are going to have to reckon with as they go forward.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point that, isn't it, Maya, that other countries, including economies that are not as developed as the United States, saw a problem before the US did. What do you think this whole episode has done to the reputation of US industry and regulation around the world?
I think it's done incredible damage, and it's actually exposed a very serious problem that we have with the United States government, whether you're talking about the FAA or other regulatory aspects of the government. The government officials are simply too cozy with the industries that they're supposed to be regulating. We see this across the United States government with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, very recently with the Environmental Protection Agency under the current administration, and in so many other aspects of the government. So it's an increasing problem now under the Trump administration, a problem that is tremendously magnified. But it is not a new problem here to the U.S., and I think incredible damage has been done to the FAA and other agencies because we've now exposed this reality.
Okay, Maya, Nisit, for now, thank you. Americans are having fewer children. The number of births in the United States fell last year to its lowest level for 32 years. Data out on Wednesday showed 3.8 million babies were born in the US last year. The fertility rate was at a record low. The figure's been below the level needed for the population to replace itself for years. And this, of course, all has economic consequences, which we'll get to in a moment. Casey Buckles is a professor of economics at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana in the US.
I think we're still trying to understand what the reasons are for the recent decline in fertility in the United States. I can start by saying there's one thing that is not an explanation, and that is an increase in abortions. That is not happening in the United States. The abortion rate is falling over the last several years as well, so that it's now lower than it's ever been since the early 1970s. We're just seeing fewer conceptions overall, fewer abortions and fewer births.
And so are Americans choosing to have fewer children?
There are some leading explanations. One is what's been happening in our economy. So if you look at the recent decline, it really started around 2007 and 2008. And that, of course, was when the Great Recession began here in the United States. The decline in the U.S. is really driven by fewer births to teens and to young women, women in their 20s. So it may be that those groups have been hit particularly hard by the Great Recession. We know that if you graduate from high school or college during an economic downturn, that you have a harder time finding a job, you're more likely to be unemployed, to take a job with lower wages. It could be that those scarring effects of coming of age during an economic downturn also affect things like marriage and fertility.
Could it be that people are feeling the fruits of economic growth and people who are better off tend to have fewer children?
Well, I think that's possible. But if you look at what's happening among certain groups who are really enjoying the benefits of the economic recovery, those would be two-earner couples, married couples, older women. They're actually seeing their birth rates go up a little bit. So I think if everybody was enjoying the Great Recession's recovery in equal measure, we might expect to see a little bit of a bounce back. And we're really not seeing that, especially for young women and unmarried women.
Do you see this trend reversing at any point?
If we look at other countries around the world, other developed countries, they have lower fertility rates still even than the U.S. So in the U.K., they're quite comparable to the U.S., but in parts of Scandinavia, Southern Europe, Japan, fertility rates are much lower. So if we look to those countries, it seems that we still haven't found the bottom here in the United States.
So it's not yet a crisis then?
I don't think it's a crisis at all, but it does tell us some really interesting things about what's happening here in a lot of sectors of our economy and culture. One thing that's capturing my attention is this rising inequality in fertility that that you have higher rates of fertility among older women, married women, educated women, and much lower rates among those who are less educated, single and young. And, you know, some underneath that, there are some good things like a falling teen birth rate. But if what's happening is that you have a class of people who can afford children and are having them, and then others who feel like they can't afford to have kids or can't afford to give them the life that they want, then I think that's that points to a greater problem with inequality in the United States.
And so what are the consequences of that for the economy?
Well, when people are worried about declining fertility, that's one of the things they are most concerned about, is the sustainability of public programs, particularly the Social Security program here in the United States. You need more young workers to support the retiring population, and we have the baby boom cohort about to enter retirement or entering retirement right now. So that's a big group of retirees, and we have an ever smaller number of working people supporting them. Now, one solution to that problem is immigration. So, you know, I think these two fronts, fertility and immigration, very much have to be considered together.
Professor Casey Buckles there. Maya Van Rossum in Philadelphia. Do you know people delaying having children, perhaps deciding to have fewer children than they would have done a few years ago?
Yeah, I am seeing that amongst colleagues, friends, and within my community. And I think they're making that choice for economic reasons, for quality of life reasons. But the truth is, they're also making that choice because of environmental concerns. People are concerned about the growing human footprint and the threats of climate change and what it means for our human future. So there are a lot of reasons, but I definitely see it.
Okay, Maya, thank you. You're with Business Matters on the BBC World Service. Stay with us. Plenty more business news, analysis, and opinion to come.
With bbc.com/news, you get the latest news stories anytime you like. bbc.com/news offers you the most comprehensive news coverage in the world, and its stories are easy to search and navigate. Whether you're interested in science, health, technology, or business, the bbc.com/news website can offer it all. It also gives you the opportunity to listen live to our news output or check the latest breaking news with our minute-by-minute news feed. If you want to take the news with you, we offer you downloadable podcasts to listen at your convenience, or archive programming so you can catch up on the programs you've missed. Or you can access bbc.com/news on your mobile phone. bbc.com/news also lets you give feedback direct to our program teams. All this content, coverage, and opportunity makes the BBC the world leader in news coverage online. bbc.com/news.
You're listening to Business Matters from the BBC World Service with me, Rob Young. Coming up, internet companies and governments promise to do more to combat extremism online. We'll be live in Asia with a roundup of the news and business headlines from across the world. And we'll have comment from our guests, Nisit Hajari in Bangkok and Maya Van Rossum in Philadelphia. But first, the news. Welcome back to Business Matters with me, Rob Young. Now, some of the world's biggest technology companies have signed up to a plan of action to combat the spread of violent extremism online. At a meeting with political leaders in Paris, businesses including Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Twitter and Facebook put their names to what's being termed the Christchurch Call. It's a response to the attacks on mosques in the city in March, which left 51 people dead. The gunman live-streamed the attacks on Facebook. The plan appeals to lawmakers to pass new measures to ban violent extremist content from social media, and the companies have pledged to do more to take down terrorist propaganda more quickly, improving technology to better detect offending material. The Christchurch Call, though, involves no new regulations. It will be voluntary, with each country and company which has signed up free to decide how to honour it. This was New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern speaking at a news conference after the meeting.
The Christchurch Call is a roadmap for action, and it is pleasing to see the statement from five major tech companies committing all of them to a set of individual actions and collaborative actions as well. This 9-point commitment will lead, I hope, and which is a first, to further change that, if successful, will help to eradicate terrorism from their platforms. new research, strengthening terms of use and community standards, shared technology development, and establishing a crisis response mechanism present very real and very tangible points of difference and change.
Well, on the same day as the Paris meeting, Facebook announced changes to the terms of its Facebook Live service after the Christchurch attacks were streamed live on its site. Now, Facebook says anybody sharing what it calls violating content, like a statement from a terror group, would be banned from using the service for a set period, probably 30 days. The Paris summit comes at a time of heightened concern about the power of social media to fan the flames of intolerance. Mike Johnson has been looking at the issue in depth.
Policing the internet these days is a gargantuan task. Every single minute, 300 hours of video are uploaded to YouTube. About 30 million messages are sent via WhatsApp, and more than 500,000 tweets take flight through Twitter. I'm outside the central London base of a US company called Akamai Technologies. It specialises in cybersecurity to try to keep its clients safe from hackers. This is a business which needs to monitor the flow of information across the internet, around the world and around the clock. The outside is a fairly nondescript office block, really. It's got a classic glass revolving door. Let's take a look inside.
Floor number two, please.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
OK, we're heading up in the lift now, up to the second floor. OK, well, I'm now walking into a room with a whole bank of screens across an entire wall, large LED screens. This looks to be the nerve centre where everything happens. I can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 screens with all sorts of charts, all sorts of graphs and data. With me here is Luca Colacciani, who's in charge of Akamai's web business in the UK. Luca, what can we see here?
On the left screen here, you can see the globe. We have servers in around 1,000 cities in 137 countries. You can see these spikes here, which can tell you the traffic in different cities. And here there's a line coming up from this location. The higher the line, the higher the traffic there. So Asia Pacific is about to sleep, so the traffic is a little bit less. In Europe, you can see a lot of traffic, and America even more.
And another of the eight screens here seems to be showing it's a graph going back around about 7 years. What's it saying? I mean, it's just steadily rising on the right here to bring us up to the current day. What's it saying?
Yeah, it says that, you know, in the last 7 years, actually, the traffic has increased about eightfold.
Eight times the amount of data is now moving across the internet today.
Correct.
Yeah, so as the internet gets a bigger place, as these numbers keep rising on the screen in front of us, does it get harder to police?
Yeah, I think it's really a never-ending battle, this one. You know, there's more traffic, there's more information to actually monitor. So more traffic means you need more police.
Claims that social media firms help promote terrorism are nothing new. Facebook has come in for some particularly heavy criticism. For example, in 2013, when it failed to remove videos showing people being decapitated. And in the immediate aftermath of the Christchurch shootings 2 months ago, social media found itself once again at the heart of a global backlash from politicians and public alike.
Terror in New Zealand. 49 people killed in shootings at two mosques in Christchurch.
Scores dead as two mosques are targeted during Friday prayers.
Police are investigating reports that an attacker live-streamed their actions.
The gunman's video was picked up and reposted by smaller file-sharing sites too. This was the New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern last month announcing her country's joint campaign with France to combat violent extremism on social media.
This isn't about freedom of expression. This is about preventing violent extremism and terrorism online. I don't think anyone would argue that the terrorist on the 15th of March had a right to live stream the murder of 50 people. And that is what this call is very specifically focused on. We are looking to seek that companies take on a role and responsibility as much as governments do.
That's a feeling echoed by Sajda Mughal. She survived a terrorist attack in London on July the 7th, 2005. It was one of a series of coordinated suicide bombings targeting commuters travelling on the city's public transport system during the morning rush hour. Sajda was 23 at the time and head of recruitment for an investment bank. I asked for her memories of that day as she took her usual subway train to work.
It was literally 10 seconds into the tunnel that there was such a big bang. It was the loudest bang I've ever heard, and the whole tube shook and came to an instant standstill, and the lights had gone out immediately at that point. I had gone into a state of shock and panic that I just remained so still. But I remember taking in for around the 50 minutes being down there, which actually felt like a lifetime. The injuries people had, the blood, the screams, people banging on the doors, people banging on the glass and frantic. And I still remember to this day that one distant voice eventually coming through the carriages saying, "It's police, we're coming to get you."
Today, Sajda works to stop young people being drawn into extremism. I wondered if she thought social media companies were doing enough to stamp out the promotion of terrorism on their sites.
No. I have faced threats personally via social media. I've faced them via Twitter, with people basically threatening me and calling me names and sending me vile abuse and hate mail as well when I come out and speak about extremism and for the fact that I happen to be a Muslim female. Most recently, actually, in fact, we had someone put out a threat of arson to our charity's premises. Social media has not done enough to tackle online extremism.
But the social media companies will say, look, we are, for example, YouTube's parent Google will say, we've spent hundreds of millions of dollars a year reviewing and taking down offending content. YouTube says over a million videos were reviewed in the first 3 months of 2019 alone. 90,000 of those were found to violate terrorism policies. Twitter will say, look, we suspend accounts immediately when we hear. So the companies will say, look, we are working hard to try and sort this out.
Well, I would say they're not working hard enough. I've reported hundreds and hundreds of accounts, vile extremist accounts, to Twitter, and nothing's being done. I could bring up hundreds of YouTube, extremist YouTube videos, and they're still online. I could bring up extremist groups on Facebook, and they're still active. So I would actually say, no, you're not working hard enough.
I suppose the sheer size of the internet, the amount of material that's now today put out on social media particularly, makes this a really difficult job. And the only fail-safe way is for everything to be vetted before it gets posted. And that's not going to happen, is it?
No, you won't have everything vetted before it gets posted, but you need to have social media companies be dedicated to want to make a difference, to want to stop this issue of online extremism. Ultimately, that is affecting all of us within society.
Western governments and technology companies themselves have in the past been wary of increased regulation because it could be seen as a move to limit free speech. Despite this, last month, Parliament in Australia passed a law making it a criminal offence not to quickly remove videos showing abhorrent violent conduct, including terrorist acts, murders or torture. Nitzana Darshan-Leitner is a lawyer based in Tel Aviv. She's already taking legal action in the United States against US-based social media companies on behalf of victims of terrorist attacks in Israel.
They are providing social media services to designated organizations. Now, according to the law in the United States, the anti-terrorism law, no American company is allowed to provide any sort of material support, any sort of services to designated organization. Therefore, Facebook, Twitter, and Google are responsible for any damage that occurred as a result of their acts to terror victims.
What do the likes of Facebook, Twitter and Google, what do they say in their defense?
They have a great defense, actually, because in the United States, there is a law called Communication Decency Act. It's a law that grants blanket immunity to social media services for any content that anyone puts on their platforms. It was a very well-intended law. Congress legislated in 1996 in order to keep the internet open, but it basically protects all the social media companies from content. I hope that eventually the Anti-Terrorism Act will govern the Communication Decency Act and the courts will allow these cases to be heard and to get a verdict against the social media giants.
The technology firms themselves protest they have been doing what they can to detect and remove extremist posts from social media. Facebook says that within 24 hours of the Christchurch shooting, it had blocked more than a million copies of the live-streamed video at the point of upload and deleted another 300,000 already posted. The problem was that copies which had been edited or recorded from a screen escaped Facebook's automatic detection systems. And how about Google, the company which owns both the world's most visited website and also the most popular video sharing site, YouTube? Well, Google likes to talk about what it calls its redirect method, where anyone searching for extremist content on YouTube is redirected to videos designed to counteract those views. For example, testimonials from former extremists or maybe imams denouncing ISIS. Scott Carpenter is head of policy at Jigsaw, that's a Google company, which develops technology to tackle violence on the internet.
I don't think that there's one center of action. I think this is a societal challenge. You need offline resources to be able to tackle what are essentially offline societal challenges. But the tech companies do have responsibilities, and I think that they're doing their best to address them. But we have to have solutions that go beyond simply taking down material, and that's why we've been really proud of piloting the redirect method.
Despite such stout defense from Silicon Valley, it might just be that the era of an unregulated internet is drawing to a close. Just last week, a report commissioned by France's President Macron recommended greater oversight of Facebook with an independent regulator. It also called for French authorities to have more access to Facebook's algorithms so they could audit its policies on hate speech. But for campaigner Sajda Mughal, concrete action is too slow coming. She's sceptical that the Christchurch call will make much of a difference.
OK, if I'm really honest with you, I mean, whilst it's a good gesture, I'm not confident that it will be making the difference that the Prime Minister of New Zealand wants it to make. And the reason why I say that is that I've read that it's a voluntary sign-up. If it was compulsory, then we would see a difference made. What I would eventually like to see are sanctions imposed on social media companies. These are profit-making companies. And so by imposing those fines, I believe that they will be then taking this issue more seriously. And it's just really unfortunate that hundreds of people have died through terrorist acts, and we're not having these companies take the issue seriously.
Sajda Mughal talking to Mike Johnson. Well, joining us on Business Matters, we have Nissan Hajari, Asia editor for Bloomberg Opinion in Bangkok, and Maya Van Rossum, environmentalist, lawyer, author in Philadelphia in the US. Maya, do you think tech companies are doing enough?
No, I don't. And I think that this reliance on voluntary action is simply not enough. We all know there are serious ramifications of the hate speech and the terrorist acts and messaging that's being shared on the via the internet. People are really getting harmed. And I think while companies do have a moral duty to act, they also need to have a legal duty to act. And their claim that they're spending, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, I think just doesn't cut it. The fact of the matter is Google, what was it, recently made $110 billion in 1 year. So $100 million is really a drop in the bucket. And as the reporting talked about, more can and needs to be done.
Nissan, should private companies, which exist after all to make a profit, be able or be in a position to decide what we can and can't read or see online?
Well, I think that's one very important counterargument here. I sympathize with the frustration with these companies, and they have not shown themselves in the past to necessarily be responsible actors in this. But I also do not know, precisely because of that, that I want Facebook making these calls, right? And I'm not sure that legislating, you see around the world, there are attempts now to legislate fake news laws. And every single one of them that I've seen is vulnerable to abuse. And it really depends on which government is in power, whether they decide to use this to go after critics, as well as, extremists and so on. It's very, very dangerous and very hard to write these laws in such a way that you're not going to cause more harm than do good. This is a never-ending battle. There have been victories in it. It's been, in the war against ISIS, for instance, much of this material has been taken down. But the fact remains that most terrorist recruitment still occurs offline, and we need more resources devoted to preventing that.
Maya, there are free speech implications potentially, aren't there? Do you not worry that some perhaps perfectly legal, although unsavoury views may well end up being removed from social media websites as part of this drive to remove extremism from the web?
I think when you engage in legislating and lawmaking, there's always a balancing that has to be done. But I think it can be done. It's been done successfully across the board in so many areas of regulation. I think we are just talking about very serious ramifications of the hate speech that is being allowed to take place, the broadcasting of the violent acts that's being allowed to take place because the companies aren't doing enough. And I have confidence that legislators, with public input, with a good public process informing them, can strike the right balance. And I just don't think it's worth the lives that are being lost to not try to properly legislate this.
Nisid, we've been talking about the large social media companies, the household names, but there are an awful lot of pretty dark, dangerous corners of the web that aren't all that difficult to find, that aren't run by companies listed on the stock markets. Do you think anything can be done about them?
Well, exactly. This is the problem that authorities have run into when dealing with ISIS extremism online. People just shift, right? You know, you're able to, these tech companies, the big ones, have developed, you know, fingerprints for ISIS Twitter handles and Facebook posts and things like that, and they share them amongst themselves, and they're able to take them down, but then they just shift to other platforms. Most of the communications happen on encrypted platforms now. They create, you know, new accounts endlessly. It's a game of whack-a-mole. You know, as soon as you like press down in one area, there are other areas where they can pop up.
You're with Business Matters on the BBC World Service. Now, we were talking earlier about the US declaring a telecommunications national emergency, paving the way for a ban on equipment made by the Chinese company Huawei. Well, the BBC's Mariko Oi joins us from Singapore. Hi, Mariko.
Hi.
And Huawei have responded to this.
That's right. Even though the statement didn't actually specify Huawei, many people have assumed that he's talking, President Trump is targeting China's Huawei. And the statement from the Chinese telecom giant says restricting Huawei from doing business in the US will not make the US more secure or stronger. Instead, this will only serve to limit the US to inferior yet more expensive alternatives. So definitely fighting back. And of course, Huawei has repeatedly said that it is not going to spy on behalf of the Chinese government. Of course, the company has been under scrutiny, not just in the US, but elsewhere in the world as well. And Huawei has repeatedly said this, but President Trump still gone ahead with this executive order as expected.
What is this going to do to relations between the US and China, which I think it's fair to say were already pretty tense?
I know. I mean, who knows where we are with that ongoing trade war between the two biggest economies of the world, which are affecting other economies around the world as well. You know, at one moment, we thought the tension was escalating with further tariffs. President Trump has since said that he still hopes that a deal would be achieved. And we know that President Trump and President Xi are likely to meet at the G20 summit, which will be taking place in Osaka, Japan, next month. So there are still some hopes that some kind of an agreement could be agreed. But at the same time, this executive order targeting, we assume, Huawei and also ZTE, another Chinese technology giant, is not going to make it easier for the two countries' relation to get any better anytime soon.
Thank you, Mariko. That's the BBC's Mariko Oi there in Singapore. Have a good day. Now we are going to talk about Go. It is the world's oldest board game. It was first played in China some 2,500 years ago. It's a game for two players. It's a game of strategy, and the aim is to surround more territory than the opponent on the board. Well, one of the world's best players of Go, Fang Hui, was famously beaten by an artificially intelligent computer a few years ago. Well, it seems he's something of a glutton for punishment, because my colleague Sarah Wang from the BBC's Chinese service spotted him at an event all about artificial intelligence in London.
Basically, it's a board with black and white pieces. Two people play it, and then they need to use strategies. They need to think. You know, people play Go are considered quite smart and very strategic thinking kind of people.
Are you good at it?
Nope, never played it.
But Fang Hui is.
Well, yeah, he's a professional Go player. He was born in China and quite young, but he became a professional player. And he is the European Go champion. Later, he moved to France to be the French national Go team's coach. And then he worked for DeepMind, which makes it's a computer program.
So he's very good at this game of Go, but was beaten by this artificially intelligent computer program.
Yes, that is a world phenomenon, I would say, because that was the first time a machine has ever beaten a human.
In a game of strategy.
Yes. So I learned about him while we were doing AI kind of stories, and I caught his name in this AI More Than Human exhibition at the Barbican Centre. I said, oh, we have to talk to him. So I grabbed him from a stand where visitors can play the Go game against the computer, against the machine. So he was trying that out. And I said, oh, well, Fan Hui, I'm so glad to see you. Could you talk to us? And he said, oh, yeah, sure. And because we speak in Mandarin, so he's quite happy to do that. I said, we're talking about your personal feelings. So I asked him, did he still remember how he felt when he was beaten by AlphaGo?
Of course I remember that. It's an unforgettable experience, an experience of a lifetime. Initially, I never thought I'd lose the game. From what I understood about AI and AlphaGo, I thought it would take a very long time for them to beat humans, but as soon as I started the game, it completely turned my view upside down. I'm a professional Go player, so when I lost the game, I felt quite down. But after a while, I felt this experience really helped me a lot. Whether they're machines or artificial intelligence, these are tools that really help us broaden our horizons and see things that we don't normally see. That can help us. For me, whether it's AI or AlphaGo or whatever it is, they can now beat humans in playing Go, but this is not the point. The ultimate purpose of playing Go is not to show you are the strongest and the best, but to understand and to learn.
That was Fan Hui there. So what is he doing now? He's very good at this game. He's proven that computers can be better than humans at playing this game of strategy. So what does he want to try to do next with the technology?
Well, it's a good question. He thinks technology is the most powerful tool human beings can have, and the people should just use the technology, use the tool to improve their understanding of the world, whatever they do. So with the help of the machine, we can learn better and faster about the game and about the world.
That was Sarah Wang there from the BBC's Chinese service. Well, let's talk to Nisid in Bangkok and Maya in Philadelphia. Maya, what's your favourite board game and how do you fancy your chances against a computer?
Oh, my. I really like Yahtzee. We play it a lot. It's not a board game. It's a game with dice. I've never played it against a computer and I don't want to.
Nisid, can we learn anything by playing board games against artificially intelligent computers? Or is it just the rather depressing fact that computers tend to be clever at predictable games like this?
Well, I'm sure it's a bit of the latter. I mean, I think we can learn anything from playing against somebody better than you, even if you are crushed over and over again, as I can be in chess.
Oh, dear.
But it's when it comes to machines, it's you know, clearly they're going to replace many, many tasks that humans do that are repetitive. But we have to understand that they're going to be able to do a lot more than that. And I think anything that we can learn from interacting with them to improve our own skills is going to serve us well in the future.
It sounds like you're optimistic about the march of AI. Maya, are you optimistic?
No, I am a little bit frightened of the growing romance that everybody seems to be having with AI. And I think what happened with the Boeing planes and all this reliance on machines and computer programming and what happened with those planes falling out of the sky when we relied on the machines and not the people is a good example of what can happen when we go too far down that path.
Well,
sorry to end it on a negative.
Maya Van Ross and Nisid Hajjari, thank you for your time on this edition of Business Matters. We're back at the same time tomorrow. Do join us then. Bye-bye.